The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
Welcome to the program. This is Mike Consul, and we are headed towards what most people are expecting to be a slowdown in the real estate market, a correction in the real estate market. Already what we're seeing are a lot of portfolios that are being reformulated to make them a little bit more recession resistant. And one of the pending questions out there is what property type will be most durable during the next economic downturn. And that is going to be the subject that we'll talk about with our guest. Her name is Spencer Alloway. She's an executive with Green Street Advisors. She's an analyst, in fact, on the retail research team, where she leads coverage of the net lease team and is a key contributor to mall research, among other things. So with that, Spencer Alloway, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Mike. Excited to be on with you today. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And you're the right person to be asking this question to, I think. You, among others that are out there in the real estate world who do this kind of research. What about that? Here comes what is inevitably going to be a recession, whether it's this year, next year, or in a couple of years. We know that these things run in cycles. And of course, people are going to be invested in real estate. What type of real estate does your research indicate is going to be the most durable during the next economic downturn?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's interesting, you know, just given my kind of background at Green Street. So, you know, I've been with the company for 6 years, and actually most of my time at Green Street has actually been spent in the mall sector. So I've kind of seen, you know, the fallout that's already occurred within retail and all the disruption that's happening there. But now, you know, leading coverage of our net lease space, which is a niche retail property sector, it's interesting just kind of see where, you know, the retail is headed in those portfolios. And as you said, you know, really start to think about which of these property types is going to be more resilient as we head towards what could be, you know, a downturn in the coming years. And Green Street's done a lot of really great research looking back on which real estate sectors tend to do better during economic downturns. And if we look at the total returns, the net lease sector has historically had more stable total returns relative to other REIT property sectors. So I would say, you know, if history is any indication of the future, which, you know, we're all taught in school that it really doesn't predicate what happens in the future, but total returns, you know, for the net lease space have certainly held up better historically than other retail spaces or other real estate spaces.
Well, I'm certainly glad you're not in the mall space anymore, because if you said, Mike, shopping malls are really going to be the property type of the downturn, I would have to say, well, Spencer, you sound a little bit biased, but at least you actually have the numbers on this. You moved into a good space. Let's not presume that everybody listening understands what net lease real estate is. Why don't you give us a brief description of it? What constitutes net lease?
Yeah, so it's, you know, it isn't one of the more, you know, talked about spaces in real estate, and like you said, not everyone is kind of aware of what these portfolios are comprised of. So really what it is just standalone retail real estate. So if you think about the portfolios, think like convenience stores, pharmacies, drug stores, those standalone retail assets is basically what these portfolios are comprised of.
So you're talking about, here's a building owned by an investor, and it's a and then is leased out to, say, a Walgreens, which is a very stable retailer that can be counted on to pay the rent, and Walgreens just don't go out of business, basically. So you've got a very stable client there in that building, tenant, and you can count on that. Is that kind of, am I in the ballpark on that one?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. A lot of times, you know, when we think about how to kind of explain or how to think about the net lease real estate property type, we often think about it as being kind of part bond-like and part real estate-like. And the bond component characteristics really stem from the fact that, as you said, you have typically have very good underlying credit. The tenants can be investment grade, as you alluded to, a Walgreens or a CVS. But what, you know, also makes it very bond-like is the fact that these leases tend to be very long in duration. So they typically average somewhere between 10 to 15 years, whereas leases tend to be much shorter in other retail property types. So that's what kind of gives it that bond-like characteristic and provides kind of like an additional safety to that portfolio type.
Well, let me ask you this. A lot of people talk about the retail apocalypse. So when you start talking about retail, I think there's a lot of investors out there that just say, stay away from retail. Retail is getting decimated. The whole e-retailing or internet commerce segment is decimating brick and mortar. Obviously, that's not entirely true, but we have seen retailers out there who a lot of people never thought would run into any trouble. And they've been felled by the you know, shifting sands of retail. So what would you say to those folks who are intimidated by retail? And I realize what you're talking about are retailers who are have a long and strong track record and are not as vulnerable to, say, Amazon and companies of its ilk. But what in general would you say to somebody saying retail at a time like this? Is that really prudent?
Yeah, no, it's a great and fair question. I think one of the key points of differentiation that we really have to think about when we talk about net lease versus the traditional multi-tenant retail spaces like malls and strip centers is, you know, what type of retail tenants are we talking about? So, sure, there has been a tremendous amount of fallout, whether it's store closures or just outright bankruptcies in the retail space. But I think it's really important, again, going back to asking, like, okay, what tenants were those? Those tended to be traditional retail tenants. And when I say that, I mean they don't really have a service component. So think about over-levered and over-stored. Their fleet sizes have just gotten too big. Apparel-based tenants. We saw a tremendous amount of fallout of those types of tenants in the last 3 years. We see continuation of filings occur. Forever 21 just filed for bankruptcy. H&M has announced store closures. It just continues to happen. But if you look at the net lease space, there's always been a very outsized exposure to service-based tenants. And actually, since 2012, we've seen exposure to service-based tenants increase over 20%. And now service-based tenants represent around or over 50% of NOI for those portfolios. So if you look at where e-commerce, you know, is disrupting, it's traditional retail spaces, right, that are not providing some sort of service. It's much more difficult to copy or provide a service online versus, you know, just kind of disrupting commoditized goods. So that's what really differentiates, I think, the net lease space from the traditional malls and strip center sectors.
So when you talk about long-term leases, which, of course, that certainly sounds like a positive, a 10 or 15 year lease because you've got that piece of real estate locked up. But I would assume there's cost escalators in there. In other words, over the term of that lease, you would build in some lease fee increases. What and if that is the case, Spencer, what are those cost increases based on? How is that calculated?
Yeah, so they tend, in the net lease space, they tend to be the lesser of two things. They tend to either be the lesser of a CPI-linked escalator or just some fixed agreed-upon annual rent bump. So in the net lease space, for at least the companies under my coverage universe, the annual rent bumps tend to average about 1.4% a year. So it's either the lesser of that or some CPI-linked amount.
So given that the net lease sector has performed very well, what generally happens is you find some sector of the real estate industry that's doing well and the money starts to flood in that direction. Is the net lease sector of real estate growing in terms of the just the percentage of real estate that occupies or controls, or does it not work that way? I mean, because there's a finite number of retailers that are out there. So is it a growing segment, or and I suppose you could think in terms of it being a growing or not growing segment in a few different ways, but I'll leave you to kind of sort that one out.
Yeah, so I'll answer them from two kind of different perspectives. So one, in terms of ownership in the actual publicly traded REITs, we're seeing, in terms of like a safe haven, we've definitely seen capital inflows from investors, the investment community, into the net lease sector. So we've seen total returns really outpace the broader RMZ and the other traditional, major food groups within real estate. We have seen that as there's been talk of, you know, getting late in the cycle, possibly towards a downturn. So we've definitely seen capital inflows into the space. I think also maybe what you're getting at too is if we think about who's actually like buying up the net lease actual properties, there's certainly, you know, from conversation with market participants and management teams, there's certainly a lot of capital right now buying for net lease real estate, across the board. So whether it's, you know, smaller local investors, your local investor just within their hometown kind of trying to buy a local drugstore, there's some competition there, or we can talk large institutional capital that's really trying to put a material amount of capital to work. They're certainly being seen in the bidding tents for net lease assets as well.
Okay, so both private and institutional wealth is in this game, and it sounds like a very safe strategy, but you know, all strategies have their Achilles heel. What might be the downside to a net lease strategy if there's going to be a weakness? If there is a weakness, what is that weakness?
Yeah, it's hard to say. That again, one of the really interesting and nice things about the net lease space, again, is the fact that it is much more insulated and does provide that safe haven in times of, you know, trouble or economic distress. And there's various reasons kind of for that. Not the least of which is the fact that the portfolios are so diversified. So it's hard to kind of point to an Achilles heel, but I will say that, you know, if there is material disruption within a certain industry, or if there's a material bankruptcies that are felt, I think that would be the real kind of knock on the space, is if we were to see retail disruption continue to kind of heat up and filter into the net lease space, if we saw accelerated bankruptcies really start to hurt their internal growth more so than it has in years past. And then on top of that, if we were to see, you know, in light of a downturn, their cost of capital decrease, then they would kind of lose their ability to grow externally. And if they lose their ability to grow externally, and all of a sudden internal growth matters, that can be very problematic for net lease, because the internal growth kind of story is not very attractive in the net lease space. It's kind of negligible at best.
Interesting. So you're on the phone with me from Phoenix, Arizona right now. You're not based there, but you're visiting Phoenix right now. And the reason I bring that up is because I've spent time in Phoenix, quite a bit of time, being an Arizona State University graduate, and know that it's got quite a retail market. And I've been, you know, lived in some other places with really strong retail markets, such as Charlotte, North Carolina, and other places. I won't detail them. But what I'm getting at here is, are there certain markets you would identify as being exceptionally strong retail markets and therefore exceptionally strong for the net lease market?
That's a difficult question to ask. I would say that, you know, there's less emphasis, I think, placed on specific markets for the net lease players. And again, that just goes back to the fact that they're so highly diversified. The point that you're getting at, I think, is much more impactful and meaningful in a space such as malls. Again, I alluded to the fact that I covered the mall space for the better part of 5 years. And if you talk about Phoenix, it's a completely over retailed market. If you look at the mall footprint, there is a tremendous amount of malls in this area. And I think Green Street is certainly of the viewpoint that there's going to be a supply contraction, that underproductive malls will go away in the future. So I think there's much more chance of that happening in the traditional space, whereas, again, like I said, in the net lease space, I think that it's highly unlikely that specific markets will see, more impact than others.
So within the traditional retail segments, which areas bear watching most closely within the net lease space?
Yeah, it's a good question. As I alluded to earlier, I mean, when we think about, specific, segments that kind of sell commoditized goods, certainly that's the first one that comes to mind. You know, we saw Amazon take down bookstores and then ironically open up some bookstores of their own. Commoditized goods, certainly an area of focus. So within the net lease space, if we think about their exposure to dollar stores or convenience stores, a high percentage of these goods are easily sold online, namely by Amazon, which can deliver them right to your door, and in some cases as soon as 2 hours. So certainly some risk there in those segments. And then interestingly, actually outside of even the traditional retail segments, even within service-based industries, we think there's actually opportunity for disruption there as well. So if we think banks, for example, traditionally when you go to a bank, you're getting a service. However, they're facing increasingly more competition from automated services, right? So now you can do a lot of your online banking, from your phone or, from your laptop. You have personalized brokerage services. All of those things can certainly make banks more obsolete. So maybe your local MSA only needs 2 banks. You don't need 5 in your general area. And then another interesting service-based component would be restaurants. And to some extent, we think that they're facing a combination of risk, not just from disruptors, so like food delivery services, but also from the fact that they are similar to apparel-based retailers. They tend to be oversupplied, and their fleet sizes are just too large. And there's also a component or a constituent of those restaurants, which are also have over-levered balance sheets. So that could be very problematic in a downturn and something that we're keeping an eye on. So restaurants and banks are an interesting segment of the service-based industry, which we think could also face disruption.
Interesting. So, and then on the other hand, you see the bank branches were supposed to go away, but we're seeing a resurgence actually of bank branches in some cases. And then you also take a look at companies like Amazon, who are now opening physical bookstores and such. So is the retail market, the retail landscape, changing in some surprising ways? I mean, obviously we've seen e-commerce now for years, and it looked like it was decimating the traditional retailers, and it has in many cases. But is it changing? Do you see the retail market changing in some surprising ways right now?
Yeah, I think you alluded to, 2 great examples. I mean, I think that there's this notion and this preconception that e-commerce is just going to, like you said, kind of decimate or get rid of brick and mortar and kind of make it very obsolete in some cases. But I think it's really interesting when we see, we see a lot of digitally native brands that are moving and taking places in high quality brick and mortar locations. So high quality malls, high quality street retail, high quality strip centers. So it's interesting because, some of these things are a little ironic. Like you said, Amazon opening bookstores. But I think at the end of the day, it's very idiosyncratic. It comes down to, particular markets, the surrounding demographics, what the consumer base ultimately wants in that general area. Densification makes a ton of sense in, a lot of places where you can, bring in an office component, you can bring in a retail component and kind of make like mini cities almost. house and kind of cater to the surrounding demographics. But it's interesting. I think it's very idiosyncratic, and what works in one area is certainly not going to work everywhere. And that's why it's up to these landlords and these owners of real estate to really understand their area and the demographics and figure out what works best, and what the higher and best use of that, real estate ultimately is.
So with regard to net lease, what have I overlooked here, Spencer? Is there another angle to this that I haven't questioned you about? Is there more to say about it?
The one thing that I would maybe note about net lease that maybe we haven't touched upon is just, I think that the structure of the leases is also, a further backbone. It just provides additional layer of protection for the space. And what I mean by that is oftentimes the net lease REITs would make use of what's called a master lease. And so a master lease kind of protects against asset-specific risk. So even if one asset's struggling or closes, for example, the rent payment of that lease is covered by the balance of the properties in a master lease. So this is really helpful. If one particular retail tenant's struggling and they wanted to close select underperforming stores, if they want to close specific stores and they're in the master lease, they're prohibited from doing that. So it kind of prevents tenants from cherry-picking assets that they want to close. And the only event that really a master lease doesn't protect against, and we kind of talked about it earlier, is if the tenant just declares bankruptcy and wants to close all of their stores. Because otherwise, that rent is secured, like I said, by all of the properties in the master lease. And like I said, it just provides additional layer of cash flow stability.
Okay, so the master lease could cover a slew of properties. And as you're saying, so I've got an underperforming store, but I can't simply close that store because I'm trying to maybe boost profitability in my overall company. I've been locked into this master lease, but it's also to my benefit to be part of this lease. I've got a long-term lease. I've got my locations, and I'm fixed in place, which is a big asset for a retailer. Assuming they operate. In a manner that draws customers and produces sales, so the master lease is yet another layer of protection there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, well, very good. Well, Spencer, thank you very much for taking the time. I think people are going to listen to this with great interest because, as I say, portfolios are being reformulated at this time. Real estate is almost always a component of any portfolio that's contains some type of alternative. And this was an interesting walkthrough. I learned some things I didn't know before. So thank you for your time, and good luck with your travels there in Phoenix.
Thank you so much for having me, Mike.